Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning. It's The Show on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, how a national monument is helping facilitate firewood collection for an indigenous community and putting a modern twist on a classic fairy tale. But first, it is time for the Friday newscap and some voices from the news this week.
The plan seems to be to break the federal government in order to help rich people. And I can't get on board with that.
We've built a very solid economic relationship with Mexico over decades. And the impacts to Arizona could be substantial.
This is an example of the president's leadership. He's a business person and he understands what works and what doesn't. And he's brought Canada and Mexico, in this example today, Mexico to the table.
We are what we eat. And the state of Arizona has a responsibility to protect our children and their health. This bill respects children, keeping dangerous chemicals away from their food.
Our role, we're taught, is to run, hide, and then if we have to fight, but only as the last resort. So this gives an option rather than being a victim.
Obviously, in the bill it says, in good faith, if they have some concerns about election, that they have the right to question that and not just feel forced to certify the election.
And with me to talk about the threat and then pause of tariffs against Arizona's two biggest trading partners, a proposal to allow guns in schools and more, our former state school superintendent Jaime Molera with the firm Molera Alvarez. Jaime, good morning.
Good morning.
And Matt Grodsky with Matters of State Strategies. Matt, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Jaime, let me start with you on the proposed and then paused tariffs against Mexico and Canada, Arizona's two biggest trading partners. It seems as though this was one that maybe people of all political stripes were, there's just general, it seemed like confusion was the biggest reaction to all this.
Well, you had a Freudian slip about this being against Arizona because it kind of would have been against Arizona. This would have been a really big hit to our economy. But I guess the Trump administration, and it's interesting how this played out. I mean, it didn't surprise me in a lot of ways because I've always seen President Trump really as a developer. I mean, that's his mentality. And the developers I've worked with time and time again are very aggressive. They really want to, you know, come into negotiations with a lot of dynamite to blow things up.
Move fast and break stuff, right?
But, you know, I got to tell you that his rhetoric in the campaign turned out to be accurate. I mean, that's one of the things that I think a lot of the folks in the Republican side of the aisle are very pleased with is that, see, finally, we have somebody who's a politician is willing to go out and say and do what he said on the campaign trail. And so I think it's going to be interesting how this plays out. I don't think it's over.
Yeah.
I certainly believe that they're going to use this stick against Canada and Mexico, as well as the EU, too, because I think that's the next one that's going to be coming down the pike.
Matt, politically, like, we've seen obviously a lot of Democrats coming out and saying this is terrible, this is bad for the economy. A lot of Republicans are saying it would probably hurt the economy as well, too. But, like, is this the kind of issue that Democrats might be able to, assuming that the tariffs go into effect at some point, is this something Democrats can take and run with maybe?
Absolutely. I mean, not that you want bad things to happen to the population and the economy, but talking about economic issues are going to be the key for Democrats in the coming months. You know, I think that the president obviously— he's out there claiming he got these concessions, even though there was some conversation that this was things they were already planning to do anyway. But I think he saw the stock market, right? And he saw the reaction from the business community, even some folks that thought he might have just been saber-rattling during the campaign. And I think he pivoted because of that, right? And so I think if he continues to do that, I agree. I don't think it's over yet.
Yeah.
So his honeymoon period could go away faster than a Mark Fincham speeding ticket if he's not careful. So we'll see.
Oh, insider political reference right
there.
Yeah,
right.
So let me ask both of you, if you think that this episode says anything or is a harbinger of the way that the Trump administration, of its relationship with Mexico for the next 4 years, and if that has any kind, what kind of impact that might have for Arizona?
Well, I believe, you know, we've been doing quite a bit. My firm's been doing quite a bit with Mexico trade issues. And certainly there's a lot of angst within not just the Mexican government, but also within the Mexican business community. Mm. A lot of investment that's been going on there, you know, people feel not at ease. Mm-hmm. I just put it that way.
Yeah.
The one thing that concerns me, though, is that over the last several years, you've seen a lot more penetration of the Mexican business market by China. And I think there's a legitimate fear that if we continue to be very aggressive and seen as anti-Mexican, then I think China becomes more of a threat in our own hemisphere.
Mm.
And that's something that it's disconcerting because I think that if you look at the amount of investments in Chinese corporations that are coming into Mexico, I think that's something that should give us pause. And that's certainly one of the things that we're going to be talking about over the next few months as we engage with Mexican business leaders as well as Arizona's political leaders.
Sure. So, Matt, do you think that this episode says anything about the Trump administration's future relationship with Mexico and maybe what that might mean for Arizona?
Yeah, I think it's instability. And I completely agree. I think the common thread that we're seeing, not just with these tariffs, but with things like USAID and kind of ceding our ground as a leader in the world, that vacuum is going to be filled by China and other adversaries. And I think as Democrats, we've struggled to articulate that to swing voters and individuals that maybe don't pay attention to the news cycle every day. You know, there's a cost for not being the leader of the free world. There's a cost for not having these relationships overseas. And when you see China encroach in our southern hemisphere, you know, that's going to have ramifications long term. So I think the common thread is instability, and we'll see what happens with that.
Interesting. All right. So, guys, at the risk of putting the cart, I don't know, 2 years before the horse here, let me ask you about the Cook Political Report. It's a prognostication service has listed two Arizona congressional districts as toss-ups among 18 nationwide. I don't think for people who are paying attention to, you know, congressional politics, this will not be a surprise. It's the CD1, the David Schweiker district, CD6, the Sisqamani district. Matt, there is a lot of talk just a few months ago that Democrats might be able to pull off one or both of those, and they didn't. What has to change for Democrats to be successful in those swing type districts?
Yeah, I'll be blunt. We have to really take voter registration seriously. It has plummeted for us statewide since 2020. We were fairly stable in 2022, but it's really gone down. I mean, you saw how competitive CD1 was back in 2022. It's gone less competitive given the voter registration disadvantage for Democrats. You know, thousands of voters have gone to independent or switched parties altogether. So if we want to actually consider these as swing toss-up districts, we need to worry about getting more voters into our tent. And until we do that, I'm concerned we're going to have the same issue over and over again.
Jaime, we've seen Congressman Schweiker listed as vulnerable for I don't know how many election cycles
he's been elected
at
right.
this point. Yeah. And he's every 2 years he pulls it out and wins. Right. What I guess is there reason to think that might be different for both he and Congressman Sisqamani in southern Arizona?
See, I don't. I think the best chance the Democrats had of unseating them is during the presidential election year. You tend to see much more higher turnout with Democrats. And in 2026, it's going to be a gubernatorial election. They're going to have a lot of interest. But I just don't think you get the kind of turnout that can beat them at this point. And then the other thing I think Democrats should be concerned about, and certainly I think this has been helpful to the Republican Party, you see a lot more dissatisfaction, particularly amongst minority groups. So you saw the Latino men vote was considerable for President Trump, but it was also very helpful to Sisqamani and Schweikert, particularly Juan Sisqamani. And I think a lot of the policies and the attitudes of the wokeness, the social policies, have been very damaging to the Democrat brand. And so that's one of the things, in my opinion, they're going to have to deal with. But certainly the Republicans are in a good position if they take that momentum, and hopefully they'll do that. I mean, I've always been disappointed in Republicans' ability to outreach to these minority groups. But there's an opening there that I think if they are smart about it and aggressive about it and put their money where their mouths are, that could pay off long term.
Obviously, 2 years is an eternity. I mean, 2 weeks is an eternity in politics. 2 years is even more than that. But at this point where we stand at the beginning of February in 2025, is it fair to say that at least to some extent, we don't know to what extent, but that the even down ballot, you know, congressional races in 2 years will be in some way a referendum on President Trump?
Yeah, it could be. I mean, and that's always a big issue. I mean, presidents usually have a tough time in the mid-elections or after their first term. Yeah. So that's where I think a lot of the opportunity that the Democrats see, and certainly I believe the Hobbs administration is hoping that that happens because they can piggyback on that.
Mm-hmm.
But as I mentioned, those other issues I think are very deep, and I think they could penetrate the psyche of a lot of voters to say, look, we don't want to go back to that. Mm-hmm. As crazy as the Trump administration might be, we just want that stability, and we want that notion that we're not going to get that kind of DEI, you know, policies that are going to affect our ability to raise our families or things like that.
Well, so Matt, as Democrats are thinking about sort of regrouping after November, how much of the conversation is about their policies and maybe trying to talk more about the economy? You've heard a lot about that. And how much is sort of anti-Trump?
Yeah. No, it's interesting. I mean, I think we recognize as a whole that we have a perception issue. You know, individual campaigns and state parties think that they're talking about economic issues and that they're, you know, appealing to the middle of the road. But the right-wing ecosystem has been able to convince a large swath of voters that our primary issues are, you know, the wokeness factor, right? So we have to fix that and address it. Luckily, we have a playbook for that. We saw that in the backlash to 2016. We had big success in 2018, but we didn't get that by being passive and just depending purely on outrage. You know, you had to message and show that you were the common sense party, and we need to get back to that. So that's going to be a key component of our strategy.
All right. That is Matt Grodsky. I'm also joined by Jaime Molera. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. The Friday Newscap continues in just a moment. Good morning. It's the Friday Newscap on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. My guests this week are Matt Grodsky of Matters of State Strategies and Jaime Molera of Molera Alvarez. Matt, let me start with you on a bill that would essentially allow guns in public schools. It would allow teachers and some staff to carry on campus as a school safety measure, its proponents say. There is some training firearms requirement. There's some sort of de-escalation training in there. I'm curious, like, this seems like something that maybe the governor wouldn't support necessarily, not trying to predict what she's going to do. But the fact that we are having this conversation, I think, says something. I'm not sure what, but it says something.
Well, let's talk about the fact that we're having this conversation. I think elections have consequences. And we've seen in polling and data over the years and as recently as last year that Arizona voters, it's tight margins, but by and large, they want stricter gun laws and common sense safety measures. And that is kind of adverse to what you're seeing come out of the legislature with, you know, Republican majorities. So this is what happens, you know, when Democrats don't win the legislature. This is the conversation we have around guns. So we'll see what happens. But I'm not so confident that that's actually going to pass and become law. But we'll see.
Does this have a chance, you think, Amy?
No.
Because of the legislature,
well,
or because,
no,
of, the
because of the governor's veto. Okay. It'll pass the legislature. It went out on a party line vote earlier mm-hmm. this week, and it'll get out of the Senate on a party line vote. I imagine it'll get up to her, be one of the first bills that arrive on her desk, but she's going to veto it. So, remember when Doug Ducey was governor, these types of bills were out there, but they were stopped, and they were stopped because, well, we don't want the governor to have to veto a gun bill. But now they have a Democrat in the governor's office. Of course, Republicans are saying, absolutely, let's give her every gun bill that we can.
Do you think that this bill would actually make schools safer?
I don't. I think it's one of those things. It's being talked about as a silver bullet. No pun intended.
Ah. Well done.
But honestly, I mean, I'm a big believer in Second Amendment and a believer of people to defend themselves. Public schools, I think, just need to be a place that it's a gun-free zone. We have sensible laws around that in Arizona. We have sensible laws around that in bars, for instance. So I just think that we just need to try and take the rhetoric out of this and try and come up with rational things to keep our kids safe.
So speaking of keeping kids safe and in this case healthy, let me ask you, stay with you, Jaime, about a proposal to get a lot of ultra-processed foods out of schools, both, it sounds like, you know, in the cafeteria, mm-hmm. but also in vending machines,
sure.
You know, a lot of chips and candy and stuff like that. This, you know, there's been a lot of talk about this with Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and the Make America Healthy Again movement. I'm curious what you make of this particular measure.
Well, I guess my libertarian bit comes out in situations like this. I'm always a big believer that that's the parent's responsibility to make sure the health of their kid is taken care of,
mm-hmm.
bottom line.
Okay.
I think there's always this mission creep in our public education system where they want to not just educate the students, which is that's their mission. That's their primary responsibility. But we're going to deal with all these other social issues. We're going to deal with sex education. We're going to deal with health now. So I would just wish that we would get back to our primary mission. Certainly talking about it and saying to parents, you know, you should, you know, and having that bully pulpit, I think, is fine and fair. But just to come down and wanting to deal with every single social issue is just very problematic for me.
Matt, it seems like it would be kind of a delicate balance of, I mean, there are studies that show that, you know, students who are not hungry and are well-fed do better in school. It's a better mm-hmm. learning environment. But I wonder, like, the difference between, you know, serving tater tots and sloppy joes every day that kids will eat but maybe isn't the healthiest versus, like, plates of broccoli, which is healthy but maybe kids aren't going to eat.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not an expert on the subject, but I think there's a healthy medium there. I am confident that there's bipartisan support for this. It does seem fairly common sense. You know, I'm sure it'll become controversial in the coming days because that's what happens with every issue. But I am genuinely curious if the superintendent is worried about what will happen at the federal level with this. As we've seen, you know, the Trump administration in the past in the first term rolled back Michelle Obama's healthy lunch program. You know, I think a lot of the people in his circle want to continue those types of rollbacks. So, you know, I understand this from the state level, but there are, you know, threats on the federal horizon as well.
I mean, might this be a way to try to get out in front of whatever could be coming down from D.C.?
It could be. It could be. I mean, we'll see. It is Tom Horn. So a broken clock is right at least twice a day, but we'll see what happens.
Do you think it's possible, Jaime, that this – I mean, obviously it's –
Yes, I believe a broken clock is right twice a day.
Not what I was going for.
Oh, sorry.
But like, I mean, obviously, you know, there's been a lot of talk and this seems sort of modeled on what seems to be coming from D.C. But in terms of the actual rules of the road, like right. Could Arizona be trying to say, okay, look, we've got our own system here as opposed to having whatever comes from D.C. be what we have to do here?
I don't think it's that well thought out, Mark. I really don't. I think this is something the current superintendent thinks will give him good headlines, and it's getting good headlines. But then I go back to asking the question, okay, what about Latino kids that bring frijoles and tortillas into, oh, that's not that healthy. You know, it's made with a lot of lard. So, again, I just wish that, you know, put the information out there, try and educate people as best we can. But at the end of the day, let parents raise their kids.
All right. So let me ask you both about changes in the governor's office, a new budget director. It was a bit of a surprise a week or so ago when the governor's former budget director announced that she'd be stepping down next week, I think, is going to be her mm-hmm. last day. Ben Henderson is going to be the new budget director. Matt, this comes at a pretty important time, right? The governor has released her budget proposal, and it sounds like, you know, they're going to start talking with the legislature pretty soon about what they might want to do for the fiscal year come July 1.
Yeah, it comes at an important time. You know, Henderson, he's not new. You know, he's been in the administration. So there's not a big learning curve there by any means, obviously qualified. I think from a political perspective, you know, voters don't care about this issue. I think if you went out on the street and asked 10 people, I'd be shocked if two of them knew about this type of stuff. So I think the negotiations will go on. I don't think that's going to throw a bunch of wrenches in the process. But from a political perspective, I don't think it carries any ramifications long term.
But in terms of the actual policy, I guess I'm kind of curious, like, what does it mean, if anything, to have somebody, yes, somebody from the administration, but somebody new to that role come in kind of midstream who didn't presumably have much of a role in crafting the original proposal? Does that matter?
I think it depends. You know, I think that by this point in time, everybody's pretty much aligned on the strategy. So I don't think, you know, bringing in a new quarterback, you know, is essentially going to change the entire dynamic of the operation. The goal is still to win the game, and they've mm-hmm. got their play. So I think, you know, given the Super Bowl's coming up, that's the best analogy I'll throw at you.
Yeah, thank you for making the Super Bowl reference.
No problem. I mean,
do you think it matters at all to have somebody coming in midstream like this?
Well, regardless, I think they had to make the change. I think Ben would be a good addition and as a budget director. But they had to make the change, Mark. When the governor's office presented to the Joint Appropriations Committees, it was pretty embarrassing. They could not answer simple questions about the budget process. Matt Gress, a former budget director for under Governor Ducey and now representative
Gress,
was merceless because he knows the budget. He knows that they didn't know simple questions. So I think they need to bring back some sense of understanding of what the process is and some confidence in that the governor's office, their numbers, for instance, the access numbers were off by $1 billion. Just basic errors were made. And so that's why I think making that change was critical for the Hobbs team.
Do you think that someone like Ben Henderson improves the situation for the governor's office?
Oh, I do. Absolutely. Yeah. I think he's got a good reputation. I'm not sure of his budget acumen, candidly, but certainly known as a bright, up-and-coming person within that administration. So I think that, again, that change was needed.
Sure. Jaime, let me ask you also about another change at the State House. Michael Hunter, the longtime chief of staff for the House, announced that he will be stepping down in a week or so.
Right.
That he has been in the Capitol community for a very long time, tons of institutional knowledge. Right. That seems like a loss to have him leaving.
It is a loss. I've known Michael. He's been a friend for many, many years. I know Speaker Montenegro was not happy with it, but he understood. It was a very serious issues that he and his family are going through. So yeah. I think it was probably the best decision for him. Certainly not the best decision for the House of Representatives. So I think they're going to, it's hard to lose somebody of that stature and his institutional knowledge.
Yeah, Matt, what do you think? I mean, obviously, as Jaime said, he's been there for a long time, knows a ton of stuff.
Yeah, I agree. Institutional knowledge, and my understanding is he's had a positive rapport with folks from the other side, right? And so I think the question I have is who comes up to replace him? And is it someone more in the mold of more of the kind of extremist MAGA group these days? And what does that do to the already tenuous dynamics in the state legislature?
I mean, that seems like another, like you were talking about the governor's budget director, like people don't necessarily know who these staffers are.
Yeah.
But what some of that behind the scenes stuff really can impact how the legislature functions and the kind of policy that comes out.
Yeah, I mean, it depends on how much influence they have, right? And I think every team has, a different strategy for what their key players do. But, yeah. I mean, this will be a wild card, right? Because I don't think it's clear who the heir apparent is. So we'll have to watch that.
All right. So, Matt, you've mentioned wild cards and quarterbacks.
I know,
I'm going to ask both of you. We've got just a few seconds left. Who's going to win on Sunday, Eagles or Chiefs? Who you got?
I'm inclined to say the Chiefs only because the refs seem to really like them these days.
Wow, conspiracy theories
on
the refs now. All right.
I know.
Jaime, who you got?
I'm going to go with the Philadelphia Eagles. I'm going to go out on a limb because I think they've done a really good job of making sure the refs are given the resources they need in order to be successful.
Oh, my gosh. Wow. I will say this is not where I thought the conversation about the Super Bowl was going to go when I asked if it was okay to talk about it. All right. So you got one Chiefs, one Eagles. Neither of you have rooting interest, though, right?
No.
You're both just watching for the ads.
Correct.
That's exactly right.
Fair enough.
And to see Taylor Swift.
Yeah, we're going to see a lot of Taylor Swift again, that's for sure. Jaime Molera, Matt Krosky, thanks to you both. I really
appreciate
it.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, kids are having the opportunity to hear an adaptation of a classic fairy tale. But first, a co-management plan is operating at Utah's Bears Ears National Monument. That means the U.S. Forest Service, Bureau of Land Management, and an intertribal council made up of members from tribal communities all work together to manage the land. And new research suggests this arrangement has an impact on the collection of firewood, which, as my next guest explains, was identified by people living in nearby tribal communities as an important aspect of their interaction with the landscape. Kate McGargle is an anthropologist at the University of Utah. She joins me. And Kate, what does this co-management plan entail? And it sounds like maybe it's made the situation better than it was while at the same time not meeting everybody's needs.
Yeah, so the designation of the National Monument had in its defining language the establishment of this co-management model, which, although not brand new in the whole world, is something really unique in the United States. And that agreement basically says that not only will the federal land management agencies, in this case, the Bureau of Land Management and the National Forest Service, not only will they be, the people at the table, but so will the tribes that have traditional relationships with that landscape. And the tribes will be represented through the Bears Ears Intertribal Coalition, which has representatives from each of the five tribes that are associated there.
Has that made an appreciable difference? I mean, has that led to things changing that from what they were before?
I mean, I think that alone is a huge step and is a huge difference from how things operated with land management in the past. There have certainly always been, or for a long time been, laws on the books that guided the land management agencies to consult with tribes. But this model actually goes a step beyond that and involves tribal representatives in ways that are much more about creating the actual management policies themselves rather than just being consulted after they're created. So how it will actually play out, we don't really know yet, but the structure itself is actually a huge step in the direction of having Native voices represented in land management.
Well, and it sounds like they kind of have those voices and a seat at the table on the front end, as opposed to sort of just being told, here's what the decision is.
Yeah, exactly. That's the idea.
So how does all this relate to the collection of firewood and some of the practices that go along and the significance that goes along with that for these tribal members?
So given that folks from the Native communities had identified firewood as a really central part of their relationship with that landscape, it was the focus of the research that I was a part of. And one of the things we found that although our focus was always on that sort of material element of the firewood itself, we found lots of different interconnections that are relevant to folks. So things like forest health, the distribution of tree species, we found that all of that doesn't exist in a vacuum when it comes to how people from indigenous cultures relate to this landscape, but it's also connected with lots of traditional practices like medicine gathering, promoting healthy, for promoting a healthy body, other things related to being on the land with other people, promoting a healthy sense of kinship, for example, and still others relating to being in relationship with other elements of the land, like connecting culturally with stories related to the landscape and philosophies. Yeah, as a non-Indigenous researcher myself, like I'm not always totally clear on those specific details because I'm not, part of that culture.
Yeah.
But the importance of those elements have been communicated throughout the research that we've done around firewood and all of those interconnections. And I think it's still kind of an unfolding process with the management and how the Bears Ears Intertribal Coalition has communicated those things. But the idea is that those relationships will be centered rather than just the resources and what they are themselves.
Well, it sounds like there are some sort of practical concerns here in terms of having wood to burn for fires, for heat or for cooking in some areas, or maybe to, help in constructing homes, but also some more maybe cultural or sacred components that are less practical and more just sort of culturally important.
Yeah, that has been kind of an interesting dimension in conversations that I've been part of over some years about this. I think with like a Western perspective, we sort of naturally separate those things and say there's sort of economics and resources over here in this box, and then there's sort of spiritual cultural health in this other box. And something that was communicated through this research time and again is that those things really aren't very separable. Like they inform each other, they're in relationship with each other. So for part of the idea of Bears Ears is to bring that understanding and awareness to how the land is actually managed through these plans.
Does it seem as though this kind of plan, this co-management plan, could be used in other parts of the country, specifically maybe other parts of the West, where, there's sort of this conflict between federal land managers and tribal communities?
Yeah, I think there is tons of opportunity for this. And I have spoken to a lot of people that want to move the conversation away from one of that's centered on this idea of conflict and move it more towards this idea that there is a lot of opportunity for collaboration. The thing that everybody wants out of these situations is for these public lands to continue to be healthy in the future and for their human communities to continue to be healthy in relationship to those lands.
So I've got to ask, because Bears Ears, of course, was the subject of controversy between the Obama administration and the first Trump administration. So now that President-elect Trump will be coming back into office, is there a concern or is there maybe a feeling that either the co-management plan or maybe how it's operated might change with a change in administration?
Yeah, I mean, certainly there is a lot of concern about that. A lot of folks are, you know, holding their breath to see what will happen. And I think the biggest challenge with that is to be in this back and forth constantly. It really makes it hard for a system of collaboration to be established, or for a system of acting upon a management policy to really play out so that we can see what works and what doesn't. I will say that, you know, I don't want to speculate on what will happen mm-hmm. over the coming years, but a lot of folks who I've worked with, especially from the Native communities, have really centered that there's been a lot of, you know, shifting currents many times for those communities. And the relationship with the land is still there and will still persist regardless of what happens with things like monument designations.
All right. That is Kate McGargle, an anthropologist at the University of Utah. Kate, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Mark.
The Waste Management Phoenix Open is in full swing in North Scottsdale. The field will get cut after today's round in advance of Sunday's final round. The tournament has for years been recognized as having a different atmosphere than other golf tournaments. But last year, the party vibe turned into a problem. Rain led to mud, which, when combined with big crowds and alcohol, became a situation where entry had to be stopped and alcohol sales were cut off. Organizers have made changes for this year's version, including adding a new entrance and getting rid of tickets that could be used for any day. With me now to talk through how things are going so far this year is Todd Kelly, Assistant Managing Editor at Golf Week. Good morning, Todd.
Good morning.
What was the conversation after last year's Phoenix Open, sort of within the golf community, about what was going on and maybe what needed to happen?
Well, it was driven by the weather, and it was all that exacerbated everything. And it became like, all right, are we at a point where some changes need to be made? And it was obvious to everyone there. And it didn't take long for the tournament organizers and the Thunderbirds to get right to work on it. It was a while before they kind of revealed how they wanted to attack this year, but they had to put a lot of thought into it. You know, they stopped reporting attendance figures after the 2018 season. So we have to sort of guesstimate what the numbers are, but they're large. And you have to always take into account the large number of people that need to be moved in and out.
Right.
But yeah, I went to check out the new entrance yesterday. It looked crowded as they're coming through security, but I stopped one fan and I said, how long did that take? And he said, only about 5 minutes. And it was a great secondary. It's a kind of this long ramp that goes up that hill, and you come in right behind 18, and it really was I think it's doing what they intended. It's a good relief point for the main entrance.
So obviously the biggest crowds tend to be over the weekend, Saturday and Sunday. But I guess, like, based on your experience having been there so far this week, does it seem as though the changes are having the desired effect?
Yeah, and you know, it's such a big property, and there's so many things happening. I could certainly give you a bunch of anecdotes, but it's hard to know exactly. You know, the tournament started technically Monday and Tuesday with practice rounds, but yesterday was the first day of competition. So anecdotally, I could probably tell you about some things, but I think we probably need to see like the full scope of the week. But you know, I think the sunny skies and the dry air is definitely helping people with, you know, bringing out the smiles, and people are relaxed and having fun. And it's a 180 from last year, not just the weather, but everything else.
Yeah, no, I'm sure no rain in the forecast helps.
Yes, for sure. And just to your point on the attendance, the best number of the week is Saturday, which seems counterintuitive to what people might think, with Sunday being the final round, but historically Saturday's been the biggest crowd and Friday's been the second biggest crowd. Sunday's a good day for like the golf fans, because by the time you get to Sunday, the partiers are sort of worn out. A lot of people stay home because they don't want to try to risk missing the Super Bowl. Sunday's a great day for golf fans. But yeah, Saturday is the high point for attendance.
So how has the reputation of the Phoenix Open evolved over the last number of years in the greater golf community? I mean, everybody here knows that it's a giant outdoor party, but like, We heard last year some of the golfers saying, okay, it's maybe gone a little bit too far. Things need to be scaled back, reined in a little bit. I'm curious what the reputation of this tournament is beyond the Phoenix area.
You mean for the players?
I guess for the players, yeah.
Yeah, well, I guess I could answer that a couple ways. But yeah, in terms of the players, we've heard before and again this year when you talk to them, what the common refrain is, we love this, we know what we're getting into, we know what this is about, but we wouldn't want this every week. So it does, yeah. So it does stand out for all the obvious reasons. And the players do love it when you see them get to 16, and some of them, Ricky Fowler is a popular golfer, and he's famous for kind of raising his arms and getting the crowd cheering, which is, you never see a loud crowd noise when a golfer's about to hit a ball.
Yeah.
But so again, they know what they're getting into. They love the atmosphere. They talk about how much fun it is. But yeah, they don't want this every week. They come and go, and they want to get back to quote unquote regular golf. but as far as the perception nationally, the media, they all know what it is. A lot of media like to come here for the spectacle and report on it. There's different angles. There's different stories to tell because of the atmosphere. But same thing, you know, when this week ends and they go on to next week in San Diego, Torrey Pines, it'll get back to that quote-unquote regular golf.
Yeah, I think the vibe at Torrey Pines is a little bit different than the vibe at the TPC of Scottsdale.
And totally different than, say, the Masters or a U.S. Open or something like that. Well, yeah. So.
Absolutely. All right, we'll have to leave it there. That is Todd Kelly, Assistant Managing Editor at Golf Week. Todd, thanks so much for your time. I appreciate it.
You got it. Thanks for having us on.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. If you think you know your Grimm's fairy tales, you haven't heard what happens when they're sung to you. The show's Sam Dingman has the story.
On a recent Tuesday morning, a group of elementary school kids gathered in a gymnasium for a theatrical interpretation of one of Grimm's fairy tales.
Now, I know many of you have heard the story of Hansel and Gretel. However, I bet you don't know this version. Even though I'm old enough now to be your teacher, I remember it like it was yesterday.
That's Mauricio Perusquia, an actor with the Arizona Opera's musical education troupe, which is called Opportunity. And when Mauricio told the kids that this version of the story might be a little different than what they were used to, he wasn't kidding.
Tra-la-la-la, tra-la-la-la, hello, how are you today? Come to sing this play. Welcome on, welcome all. My name is Hansel, and this is my story. My name's Hansel, you might know me. I am from a famous family, 'cause when I was about your age, I was caught in a witch's cage. Soon you
At first, when Mauricio started singing, the kids in the audience jerked their heads back. Opera is a lot to handle, no matter where you are. But in an echoey gym, it hits extra hard. From their reaction, I got the sense that a lot of these kids were hearing the human voice do things they had never heard it do before. But once they got used to it, I watched them all start to lean forward. And before long, I could see them hanging on every word.
Oh, once upon a time in a deep, dark wood, two children ran away just because they could. They were free to...
The first half of Opportunity's version of Hansel and Gretel goes more or less like the Brothers Grimm version. As you just heard, two children, the eponymous Hansel and Gretel, run away from home and get lost in the forest. They end up being lured into a cabin by a witch who promises them cookies. Eventually, they realize that the witch is only feeding them sweets to fatten them up so she can eat them. Now, in the grim ending, Hansel and Gretel hatch a clever plan to turn the tables on the witch, and they stuff her into her own oven. But in Opportunity's take on the story, the action freezes right before that happens.
Stop! Everyone thinks this is how the story ends,
but it wasn't like that at all. The true ending is far more magical.
Instead of murdering the witch and fleeing, Hansel and Gretel sing a song that their parents taught them. And it turns out the witch has heard it before.
Wait! I know that song! Where did you learn that?
Our parents taught it to us when we were little!
We've known it our whole lives! My parents taught me that song when I was young.
Do you have parents?
Oh, had parents. However, I got lost in the woods and never saw them again. I hated them for never finding me. How could they just give up like that? So, I made it...
The witch explains that she only started luring lost children to her cabin because she wanted everyone else to suffer the same way she did. Hansel and Gretel ask if the witch ever considered asking for help. Maybe, they suggest, they could help her find her parents. And they take it one step further.
But I'm an evil witch! How can I change?
By asking for help!
And using your powers for good!
You can use your special powers to help all the lost children be found, so that way no one has to go through what you experienced.
Yes.
The witch agrees, and she joins hands with Hansel and Gretel.
When our hearts begin to stray, help each other find a way. Take my hand and hold on tight. I will help you find the light. It shines forth from me.
At the end, grown-up Hansel returns to the stage.
So you see, and now you know how the story really goes. With some help and some smarts, we transform the witch's heart.
So you see, and now you know how the story really goes. With some help and some smarts.
After the show, I spoke to a third grader named June.
Did you know the story of Hansel and Gretel before you saw this?
Yes, I did.
What did you think of the way they changed the story?
I like that it was just like a happy ending.
One of June's classmates was standing next to her, and he agreed.
What's your name?
Luis.
Nice to meet you, Luis. What did you think of the show?
It was nice.
It was nice? Did you know the story of Hansel and Gretel also?
Yeah, but I only know the other way, not the actual way.
Now, you heard that, right? Luis just called the ending of the opportunity version of Hansel and Gretel the actual ending. And that's not because he doesn't know what happens in the Grimm version.
Usually saw what happens when I first saw it is when she dumped the witch in the oven.
But if you recall, in the opportunity show, right before the oven thing would have happened, Mauricio came out and told the audience, no, that's not the real ending. And that what they're about to see is the true ending. Luis, it would seem, took him at his word. I talked to Mauricio after the show, too.
You know, back when I was a kid, there was like, you know, G.I. Joe and Cobra or whatever, and there was clear bad guys and clear good guys. But we don't want people to think that, you know, somebody's just going to be their enemy forever if they can do something about that.
I also spoke to Cassie Hollerback, the director of education for Arizona Opera. I told her I was really hung up on this whole thing about the ending.
It's like a very trauma-informed version of the ending to me, where like the Hansel and Gretel don't just figure out how to get away. Mm-hmm. They figure out how to like call the witch in.
Right, absolutely. They take that bully figure and they figure out how do you bring her in and how do you turn what may be that negative or bullying quality into a way that you can help.
Cassie pointed out that in the resource materials that Opportunity shares with teachers to accompany the performance, they make it clear that the original ending is much darker. But there's plenty of darkness in the real world. As adults, we're reminded of that every day. For kids, there's still a chance to believe in a version of reality where unlikely companions work together to help each other find the light. And if that's not a convincing idea on its own, well, that's where Mauricio and his fellow cast members come in.
The singing is attractive to the human brain. There's something about it that just somebody's doing it right, it makes you look.
Help each other find the way.
For KJZZ's The Show, I'm Sam Dingman.
That's it for this episode of The Show Podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.